Coming up on AI Haven't a Clue.
Ahmed Zaidi on how AI is making fashion more sustainable.
I think there's going to be another level of discovery that has to be inspired by psychology or the human cognitive function that allows us to accelerate to the next stage of these technologies.
We're covering all the latest news in the world of AI. It's so weird, James. This is bizarre. It's going to respond better if we say we're going to punch it in the face if it doesn't get my search to find a holiday right.
And we take your questions at the end.
Well, hello and welcome to AI Haven't a Clue. Thank you so much for listening. My name's George Butler, recording not from the studio today. I'm abroad, but James Chandler, our AI expert, thankfully, is there.
I'm fully here, kind of doing both jobs. Easier than what you think, actually. Maybe I should have an AI year. I was sort of thinking that as I sat down.
This could be a voice clone. You wouldn't know. Especially after last week's episode. Who knows? It might not be me. I might be dialing it in all the way from a holiday.
We've got loads coming up today, haven't we?
Yeah, very, very exciting. I am taking 10 minutes away from my trip to AI land to hear all the latest news from the world of AI, funnily enough. So we're looking at why people should be mean to AI. That's right, mean. Along with why people still want to talk to humans and not chatbots. And why schools are having to go analog because of cheating.
Do you ever worry about the fast fashion industry when buying another white t-shirt from ASOS? Well, fear not, as we're chatting to Ahmed Zaidi, discussing how he's using AI to change the fashion industry to make it more sustainable.
Plus, of course, James is answering one of your questions. You're putting our AI experts to the test. It's a tough one this week. And we're going face to face in a spooky AI challenge.
Ooh.
But first, let's kick off with finding out what's been making headlines in the world of AI this week. James, let's begin with AI therapy. It's something that we've touched upon a little bit in the previous episodes of the podcast, but it's starting to be used in parts of Asia now.
Yeah, it was a cautionary tale when you talked about it before. Yeah, specifically in Taiwan and China, young people are turning to AI chatbots like ChatGPT and some of the domestic alternatives, things like ErnieBot and SenseChat. For therapy, citing reasons like, you know, it's not got the stigma of talking to a therapist, and not forgetting that access to therapists might not be as we kind of imagine it. So AI playing an interesting role with people opening up about stuff.
Yeah, so I suppose on the positive side of things, it means people are more likely to have open and honest conversations and get their feelings out there, but there is also a kind of a risk associated, isn't there?
Yeah, I think the risk is sort of fairly obvious. You know, these aren't trained health professionals. On the positive side, you know, there's an accessibility thing. There's a kind of immediacy, you're not waiting for an appointment. And in a way, there's a kind of a discretion thing. You're not sat opposite someone and you're sort of sat on that quite stereotypical couch, like opening up to a human person. Of course, though, it's missing so much. Part of that professionalism and brilliance of therapists is their ability to read things like non-verbal cues, which, of course, things like ChatGPT won't be doing. Plus, and we talked about this before, George, it can kind of reaffirm what you're thinking already. So rather than giving you solutions that are quite objective, it might just reaffirm what you're saying or be overly positive about things. So I think as an entry point for some people, I can kind of see the use there. But we said it before, it should really be used with caution. It's not a substitute for getting proper professional care.
Yeah, it's interesting. We had Dr. John Woodward, an AI expert, on a few episodes ago. Very positive. It's his job. He works, lives and breathes it. And the one thing he said he doesn't want AI to go into is this space. His example was, well, if you tell AI that you're stopping your medication and it reaffirms that it's a good thing, there are kind of big risks there. So it's very interesting, and I'm sure we'll hear a lot from, you know, mental health charities and also experts in the industry over the coming months about this. But we're going to move on now to something very strange. We talked about this man, Sergey Brin, one of the founders of Google. We talked about him recently. He's kind of jumped back into the world of tech because AI has excited him so much. But what's he said about getting the best out of AI, James? These words can't come out of my mouth. They need to come out of yours.
Well, look, you're right. Sergey Brin, who was one of the founders of Google, he's come out of semi-retirement to work on Google's AI called Gemini. He thinks it's a pivotal moment for tech and no computer scientist should be left on the sidelines. So he's back kind of rolling his sleeves up and getting stuck in again. He was on a podcast, the All In Live podcast. I've never heard of it. I mean, this is the top AI podcast you should be listening to, quite frankly. He was saying that some AI models respond better to threats, not kindness, which is kind of at odds with what we've talked about before with Sam Altman, who's the CEO of OpenAI, saying, actually, it maybe pays to be a bit friendly, although that could be using not great from a sustainability point of view, but actually it pays you to be more friendly. Sergey Brin, completely polar opposite on this.
Why? Is that because historically, like, people have, you know, in our history, succeeded through, you know, fear and negativity? And is that why? Is it using our data of awfulness in the past?
It might be the sort of the plundering of villages once upon a time that's sort of coming through here. But he said specifically on this podcast, he said that models tend to do better if you threaten them, like with physical violence. And he went on to talk about sort of kidnapping and stuff like that.
It's so weird, James. This is bizarre. We've covered some weird stuff before. This is as strange as it gets. You're telling me a computer is going to respond better if we say we're going to punch it in the face if it doesn't get my like search to find a holiday right? What's
I'm
going to
try it. My next week's usage of AI is going to be very direct and as Sergey say, quite threatening. And I'm going to see. I'm going to report back next week on how I get on.
I can just see the search now, James. Open up ChatGPT. Tell me about nice coastal villages in Spain that I can visit on my holiday. But you better get it right, otherwise I'm going to stab you in the back 350 times. Found it. Right. Let's move on quickly from that very strange story. AI had quite a big impact on the finance retail brand Klarna, but it didn't work. What's going on here?
Well, yeah, they were very public and came out and said that they could use AI to replace customer service roles. So they cut out 700 human customer service roles and then kind of installed AI in replacement for them. But the CEO, Sebastian Siemiatkowski, he's now admitted that the quality of service they're offering customer is lower. So he's had to row back on being so pro-AI, and what they're going to do is a pilot whereby they're going to get humans back in a kind of gig economy sort of, they talked about this Uber-style setup that they're going to use. Lots of the people that have been outsourced, they're going to be replaced, but they're going to be replaced by humans who humans can talk to. So yeah, not quite the AI revolution for Klarna that we thought.
Is this going to be one of the big themes that we see over the next few years, where businesses experiment with AI, they overuse it, they underuse it, they struggle to find the happy medium, a bit like working from home? That conversation is still ongoing, isn't it? It's like, what's the right amount of time to bring people in? Is this a theme we're just going to see rolling on and on and on?
Well, I think there's going to be experimentation. And look, Klarna have come out and clearly taken a big swing here and have done it quite publicly. But it's experimentation, and sometimes it's kind of not going to go right. I mean, did you need to replace 700 jobs, or could you have maybe done it with 7 or 17? I don't know. So there's kind of margins of how big you want to swing. But yeah, it feels like AI is not, you know, if you're looking for stories on which jobs AI is going to replace, this one sticks out as one where it's not going to do that job. So yeah, more humans in the time being, not moving away from AI completely, just rowing back slightly on what the intention was.
Okay, a quick one to finish. We have talked in previous episodes about people using ChatGPT to cheat on writing things, perhaps doing their homework, maybe even things like dissertations. But we're seeing a kickback, especially in colleges in America.
Yeah, you're right. So lecturers in some American universities/colleges are going analog. They're asking students to turn in handwritten in-class essays. You don't go away and write this thing, you kind of do it in class. There's a really interesting trend here, which the Wall Street Journal is talking about, and they're tracking the purchases of blue books, so physical blue books, which have just kind of shot up because these lecturers and academics are demanding that people kind of write in them. There's two really polarizing schools of thought here. There's some people that are saying AI is lobotomizing tomorrow's young leaders and tides of anti-intellectualism, which is kind of one extreme. And at the other, people are saying, well, look, kind of get with the program. AI's here now. You're not going to dumb people down by making them write in physical books. So again, I feel like this is one that's going to kind of go on and on and on. But we do need to work out a way where we make sure people haven't got an unfair advantage just because they can use the technology better than someone else. Is getting people to write in paper books the answer? Don't know.
I quite like the fact that we're dragging people back into using old school pen and paper. Come on. They've had it too easy. They've been cheating on their own work. Get back using pen and paper. Love it.
Oh.
Right. Okay, it's time now for one of your questions. It could be about anything, ideally about AI. Thankfully, this one is. And as always, if you fancy asking us a question, if you fancy asking James a super difficult question that's going to make him sweat behind the microphone, it's so hard, then obviously we want to hear it, please. AIHaven'tAClue@gmail.com is where you can get in touch or leave us a comment on any of our social media videos. I think we've got a Substack as well, which you can subscribe to. Find it in the show notes. Right, this question comes from Tommy. What does the UK need to do to make sure it stays at the forefront of AI innovation? And how do we make sure that we don't fall behind? Good question, Tommy.
It is a good question. And I wasn't so much sweating at the microphone thinking about this one, but it is kind of multi-layered. I think to make sure that the AI stays ahead, I think there's a couple of things. The really important thing is that we kind of protect the talent that we've got in AI. So there's the Alan Turing Institute is one of the top AI institutions. We've got big labs, AI labs at the big universities, Oxford, Cambridge, Imperial. So you've got to retain that talent. You've got to make it attractive for them to want to come and do their work here. Researchers, engineers, founders. There might be things like, you know, are there more grants that the government can offer? Are there incentives? Could there be some tax relief for research and development? So you've got to basically make the UK attractive if you want to be at the forefront of AI innovation. The next thing is something that we talked about before, which is around the really good question around regulation. Now, the government have got this very pro-innovation approach, which they've outlined in their AI white paper, but that really could be the UK's competitive edge and sort of keeps us at the forefront. Like, we could credibly be the country whereby, you know, the checks and balances in AI are so good that, you know, globally people come to us, and that's kind of what we're known for. The last bit I would say, the very obvious point, is kind of around accessibility. What a lot of people talk about is AI fluency. So should it be something that we're teaching in schools and is in the national curriculum? Should there be training initiatives for small businesses, for example? Also, don't make it this really cool, trendy, London-centric thing. It has to be something that benefits everyone. And could the government almost be the biggest customer of AI in the way that they put it into the NHS, into things like defence, into education? They could really role model this. There was something fascinating that I saw as well, which is going around on social media, in that ChatGPT Plus, so the kind of the premium version of ChatGPT, which opens up more features that you pay for, is going to be made free for all residents in the UAE. And so there's lots of reports saying they're going to be the first country, the first kind of AI emboldened country. Now, imagine that if the government came out and said, look, we're going to give you all of these features that you usually have to pay for. We're going to pay for them for you so you can kind of use them all. That would absolutely keep you at the forefront of innovation. So I think there's a few bits to the question, but ultimately I think you've got to really look after the talent, make it attractive. And then how do we kind of embed it in our everyday lives so it's not this kind of cool, trendy London thing?
I'll tell you what, I'm not going to say this very often, James. Pretty good answer right there. Pretty good. Slick here. I hope you were listening. Hope you're listening to AI Haven't a Clue. If you are, please subscribe, review, leave us 5 stars. It helps the algorithms.
Yeah, it's got one or two things on at the moment, Sakia.
Don't forget, if you've got a question for us, I've already told you how, get in touch. We would love to hear from you.
Today's guest is Ahmed Zaidi, founder of Hyron Technologies, AI researcher at Cambridge, and a man on a mission to fix fashion's waste problem with the power of AI. From growing up in a family-run knitwear business in Pakistan to tackling supply chain chaos with cutting-edge tech, Ahmed's journey is anything but ordinary. Let's get into it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's so lovely to have you on because we love bringing guests on using AI in all sorts of different ways. And we're going to get into how you're using it very, very shortly. But to start with, this is very impressive. Your PhD from the University of Cambridge, no less, was in AI. So if you had to condense everything that you learned down to just one piece of advice on this topic, one learning, what would it be?
That is a very difficult question. The thing that I always give an example of is this idea that the world that we live in today is like a horse carriage and AI is a jet engine. And the problem with using AI in the world that we live today is that if you attach a jet engine to a horse carriage, it's going to, you know, not make the horse carriage go faster. It's going to actually scare the horses and, you know, incinerate the carriage. So the key thing about AI for me and the learnings and actually applying it in practice is that you actually fundamentally have to think about what the world that you're applying it in is. So do you need to redesign the horse carriage? Do you need to redesign the chassis? Because the existing processes that exist in the world aren't adaptable or aren't compatible with the opportunities that AI can present. And that extends from the legal framework to the individual things that we do that we're trying to automate. And
so how does that convert to the world of fashion then, to jump in there? Are there processes within fashion that are rigid and fixed? And I mean, you talk about fashion being kind of broken and lots of wastage. What do you mean when you say that?
It's important for us to understand, how did we get to this state of overproduction? Popular opinion states that, you know, the reason why fashion is overproducing is because of industrialization, mechanization, and, you know, producing a lot. But that's actually not entirely accurate. The rise of standardization in fashion emerged from the standardization of sizing. So even before mechanization, you know, you would go to a tailor and you would get your clothes made custom.
Yeah.
But then they're like, wait, we can create sizes, you know, small, medium, large, and we're gambling that somebody's going to fall into one of these four or five sizes. And as a result, what emerges is this idea of inventory. Because prior to that, fashion didn't necessarily hold inventory. Everything was made to demand.
Got it.
So as you create these inventory, you create risk. So fundamentally, the key problem became, how do I predict what people want to buy? And for many years, they found ways to overcome this, you know, issue around not being able to hold the right inventory. Let's just say, for example, in the Victorian era, trends changed every 7 years. But now they change every 7 days. And so the ability to react to the volatility of those inventory and the demands makes it such that the inventory becomes exponentially more risky. So brands solve this by outsourcing. You know, Nike was the sort of first one to pioneer this, going to Japan, trying to make shoes there and importing it to the US. And that delta was is how they overcame that inventory risk. So the model in fashion became, doesn't matter if there's inventory risk, we can make it cheaply, get the wrong product, some of it would sell, yeah, but we can discount it and get the rest out. And that has been the prevailing model in fashion. So what's happened now is that over the years, the cost of manufacturing has gone up. So there's no more cheaper places that they can go. The velocity of demand changes because of Instagram and, you know, human attention has accelerated. And so as a result, that arbitrage, the being able to buy cheap, sell, and discount doesn't work anymore. And so now you have, you know, lots of brands going bankrupt. You have excessive waste, people trying to find other mechanisms. And so coming back to the AI, a lot of people try to solve this problem by trying to make models that can predict the future, forecasting models. I am fundamentally against that.
Right.
Predicting human behavior is a random walk, which means it's mathematically intractable. And as a result, there's a lot of snake oil out there, companies being set up pretending to be able to predict the future.
Yeah.
Brands work on 18-month cycles. So the forecast models that they're building, they're trying to predict 18 months out for something that's actually a lot more complicated than weather, human behavior. And so therefore, that's my way of saying that you can't predict the future. So when you want to think about how you use AI in fashion, you have to fundamentally rethink how is it that we want fashion to operate? How do we want to make and sell? And that gets into a much more complicated conversation, but that on a high level, that's how I see the challenges of, you know, the horse carriage and the jet engine.
Yeah.
What are you doing about this, and how are you bringing AI into hopefully the solution?
We are fundamentally trying to change the way the process is. So as not exciting as that sounds, the devil is in the details. So what we're trying to do is to rethink, how do we buy, how do we mitigate the risk of inventory, and how do we create a level of agility and flexibility in the supply chain that allows us to react? So there's a level of humility that we're trying to bring into the conversation in fashion. Let's accept we don't know what consumers are going to buy. Let's just accept that. And going to, you know, Nassim Taleb's idea of anti-fragility, let's design a system that assumes that your forecasts are wrong, that you that assumes that you can't predict human behavior. And what does that model look like? The forecasting model that exists and prevails in fashion today is fundamentally built on a level of hubris that says that we have the capability of predicting what consumers want. Let's reject that claim and build a system that is designed for the idea that we cannot predict the future. And what actually that emerges and converges to is that let's try to create a system that is reactive, that is agile.
Where do the two sort of Venn diagrams of AI and fashion come together for you in your kind of story? Went to Cambridge, graduated with this degree. At what point did you see it being of use and applied in this fashion world?
So I think my story starts much earlier. So my family are actually third generation apparel manufacturers. Mm. And when the financial crisis happened, a lot of the brands that we worked with went bankrupt. And as a result, they defaulted on their payments for my family. We had preemptively, and this is very normal in the supplier segment of the fashion industry, we preemptively, based on their forecast, held an amount of raw material, yarns, fabric. And so when they canceled their orders, we were still liable for that material to our suppliers, the yarn makers and the fabric mills. Unfortunately, I'm originally from Pakistan, and in that part of the world, there's no concept of limited liability. So if you owe money to a company, even if it's a company-to-company relationship, it becomes personal.
Right.
So for me, at the age of 16, I witnessed with my own eyes a group of people coming into my house with guns and essentially saying, you owe us money. So I witnessed the firsthand impact of how bad forecasting and uncertainty can affect real people. Not to mention the number of people who worked in our factory that lost their jobs. So that was actually a part of my life which I tried to sort of ignore or suppress. Mm. But in a weird way, when I went to Cambridge and I was a PhD student, PhD students don't make a lot of money. So I was doing a lot of consulting work. And one of the companies I was working with was a fashion company. And they asked us, hey, would you be able to help us build a markdown optimization model?
Right.
So markdown optimization model is, at the end of the season, how much do we discount to get these products out? Okay. At that point, these two worlds clicked for me. It's like, wait a minute, we're discounting $25, $35, $40 on each garment. But on the other end, we were being negotiated down for 5 cents on the cost of production. How does this make sense? But that's because everything I said earlier, the whole model is built around buying cheap and having enough margin to discount to get the product out. That's just the design of the business model. So I felt like I had to talk about that. And that conversation led me to a mission, which was, I think I can try to redesign the process of fashion and find a way to fundamentally change this old arbitrage model, which is based on low cost production and markdowns, towards, let's focus on trying to sell more full price. And actually, it turns out that you can actually make less. And if you sell more at full price, you end up making more money. Gosh. And you make things that people actually want instead of trying to stimulate demand through discounts.
So obviously, AI, I know very little about it, but I do know it's built on data. And the more data it gets, I guess, the more intelligent it gets. So what kind of patterns or improvement are you seeing in your line of the AI sector?
The problem with AI today, I think, in the sort of public discourse, is that there's a lot of conversation around what it can do, what it can't do, where is it going, is it going to take over? But as an academic, I've seen fundamental breakthroughs. There's a lot of incremental research, which kind of pushes the needle a little bit, but there are stepwise changes when these breakthroughs happen. And if you go back through history and see when did these stepwise changes happen and what were the things that initiated them, it turns out it all falls back into understanding human behavior. But at the end, I think moving forward, if we really want to progress on where we are today, there's obviously more data, more computational power that will most definitely extend the model performance. But to really have that stepwise change, I think there's going to be another level of discovery that has to be inspired by something about the human condition or the human psychology or the human cognitive function that allows us to accelerate to the next stage of these technologies.
What do you think? What's your hunch on what that could be?
I think that might be reasoning.
Mm.
So how do we reason as humans? And I can't pretend to comment because I'm not a cognitive scientist, but I think that understanding how we reason internally, and that's an area of weakness for the existing model. I know there's reasoning listed on these models like, oh, I want to add deep research. I want to do reasoning on my model.
Yeah.
In actuality, that's not real reasoning.
Talking about how AI is going to revolutionize, I've learned more in the last 15 minutes than this is incredible. What are you doing next week?
The most excited I've ever seen James ever before. He's never been so happy. James is there, like, understanding all of this detailed tech stuff. And I'm like, yeah, no, I get it. I totally get it. before we say goodbye, bring it kind of back down to, I'm going to say, my level here. What would you say is one everyday change that you'd bet on over the next 5 to 10 years changing and revolutionizing our lives?
It's very difficult to predict over the 5 to 10 year horizon. But if there's a change that I do think will, or most likely will occur, is the way that we approach information and knowledge. So that's kind of abstract. So let me distill it down into simple terms. Information and knowledge are not the same thing. Knowledge is the abstraction of information. And because of ChatGPT, one of the things that we are seeing is that we are no longer, you know, searching through a bunch of pages to try to find an answer to a statistic. Like, now statistics are at the tips of your fingers and you can just type into ChatGPT and it'll tell you exactly what percentage. So what I think how that will impact us over the next few years, and I know it's not exactly habits, is that if you think about discovery and innovation, but I see that in going forward, because we're looking for things and we're getting those answers in such precise terms, the level of exploration that we have through our discovery, our natural discovery through searching through pages, there might be 300 words of text or 1,000 words of text. You only need maybe 15 words on that text, but you read another 3,000. And that additional information is stored within you somewhere. But what that means in the long run is that we have less and less exploration, which means less and less spontaneous discoveries or the interactions of different ideas coming together, which is actually how discovery made. If you go back and look at, you know, Nobel laureates or look at, you know, even the polymaths of our, you know, of our previous century, people like Isaac Newton, they were all polymaths. And the reason they were able to make discoveries was that they were able to combine disparately unrelated ideas together to look at things in a new lens. And I think going forward, we're at a serious risk of not being able to do that, because we're not looking for things in an exploratory way. And we're looking at things in the precise way that those models give us.
Oh, so good. So good. Ahmed, thank you for giving us some time. Thank you for educating us. I mean, George has never seen me so happy. I've never seen George so perplexed and wide-eyed. That was awesome. Thank you very much for coming on.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much, Ahmed. James, you love that. Shall I pretend like I understood most of it, or I don't know?
I was looking at your expression through most of it. I mean, I was absolutely enthralled. I think we went in to get a view on fashion and AI and those two things come together. And what we got was a sort of incredible potted history of AI. I mean, his brain is just immense, but he wore it so, so lightly. He's so kind of considered in what he was saying. Yeah, I love talking to academics as well. They've got a really interesting take on AI.
Yeah, that was very, very interesting. And thank you to Ahmed for joining us. Okay, right. You might think this podcast is scary just because of how James and I present it, but it's about to get a whole lot more spooky. As we enter this week's James... Cue spooky voice, please. AI challenge. That was as spooky as I could do. Right, we are getting into it now because every week James and I go head to head in a challenge themed around identifying what's human and what's AI. And I lost count. I've lost a score. I think should we reset to 0-0?
No, I am. You know, it's like hare and a tortoise here, mate. I'm 3 up. I'm not going to sleep on the side of the road, and it's going to overtake me. There's very little I wouldn't do to win, quite honestly. I'm sorry about that. I make no apology.
Listen, you're clearly very confident, borderline cocky when it comes to this AI challenge, and I think that might be your downfall. I'm sharp. I'm on an edge. We're going to get into it, and hopefully this is the week I start to make my comeback. And of course, here to tell us all about this week's AI challenge is our incredible, creative, visionary podcast producer, according to ChatGPT. It's Molly.
So this week, I have a spooky challenge for you all. We've got a 100-word story. One is made by AI, mm-hmm. One is made by a real person. Horror-themed, hopefully it puts a shiver down your spine. Cue the spooky music. Are you lost? He spins round to see a teen girl wearing dirt-splattered overalls, smiling ear to ear. They are surrounded by looming pine trees. With a creased map between his hands, he barks a laugh. Seems so. Must have got turned round on the trail. Her giggle is a tinkling bell. Lots of people get lost in the woods. Even me. You're lost too. A whistling howl in the distance. For a long time, she nodded, teary-eyed. Do me a favour, mister. Tell them I'm right here, that I'm buried right here. Please. And the girl vanished into the mist.
Oh, God. It's always mister, isn't it? It's always mister.
Mister.
Tell them, mister.
I should point out at this stage, for everyone listening, we can't see these written down, which means we can't see all the Oxford commas that the ChatGPT one would have generated. So we're in blind here.
Giveaway.
Molly, over to you for number two. I can't wait for this.
In the quiet village of Elmbury, the church bells began ringing again, always at 3:07 a.m., though no one had pulled the ropes since the vicar's wife vanished in 1842. They say she went mad, speaking in tongues, scratching symbols into hymn books, until they locked her beneath the church. Newcomer Simon scoffed at the legend until the bells woke him one night. Drawn to the church, he found it open, candles flickering on their own. As he turned to flee, the door slammed. From the crypt below became a low, wet whisper.
We've been waiting for a voice like yours.
Then the singing began.
My God. If this all falls through, I think you've got a career in, like, horror audiobooks. The voice was terrifying.
Terrifying? I think I'm pretty confident in this one, James.
Oh. I'm wondering if I just let you have this one.
Let me have it. This is okay. You know what? I'm going to go in there early. I'm going to let you think about it. You clearly need a bit more time to think about it. I am going to lock in story two as Molly's real story. Story one as AI. Molly AI. Molly. That doesn't work.
No, I'm going to go the other way around.
I'd have the drama.
So, the real story, written by not me, I took it from somebody else, I'll put the link to it in the description, was story one. Story two is AI. The church bells is AI.
Just a guess on that one, but that's absolutely fine. Can sniff them out. It's like a pig going for truffles. I can sniff out this AI. Wonderful,
that's
there it is.
Disgusting. Audio image.
That's fantastic.
that's scarier than both those stories combined. I shocked. I genuinely am really surprised. But
it was really good, wasn't it? I thought the second one was scarier.
They were both great. I think anything that talks about speaking in tongues just gives me the shivers. Oh,
I'm kind of horrified that I got that wrong. I really, of all of these challenges you've done so far, I did not want to get that one wrong. And goodness. Amazing.
Can I ask a serious question? Have we got enough episodes left for George to even pull close?
Okay, it's a long old run, James. Unless they cut our commission short because of how boring you are about these AI challenges. On that note, please say goodbye.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, if you've got a question for us, AIHaven'tAClue@gmail.com. And we're on all the socials, aren't we, George?
Indeed we are. Big thanks for listening to this week's episode. Thanks to Ahmed for joining us. A huge thanks to Team AI Haven't a Clue, Molly Carter and David May. And if you did enjoy it, we would love for you to subscribe and maybe even rate us. If you want to leave a review, you can be very positive about the whole podcast. And frankly, I don't care if you're slightly negative about James. That's fine by me.
Or you could speak in tongues as you do the review, maybe.
Either way, yeah, it's good for the algorithms, as I said. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next time. And remember,
stay curious.